that just jived for me. Good evening, everybody. Crafty from Craftworks Distillery and Aussie Craft Distillers shooting the shit. And it's a Thursday night. Every second week, we do our little shooting shit episode. And tonight, we've got a special guest. They're all special guests. But this one, Tim's been around for quite some time. So, Tim from Canberra Distillery. Tim, how are you, mate?
Mate, thanks for having me on. Very well, thank you. Yeah, going for a little while. We're just about to clock up our 10th anniversary.
Oh, 10.
Nice. Yeah. Look, so I don't know the numbers, but I was somewhere around about in my membership at the Distillers Association. I think I was in the 70s or 80s, so that was before we hit triple figures.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. And now we're 750, 51, 52, 53. And so it goes.
Exactly. That number alone, saying 700 odd distillers in the country. Obviously, I've just come back from a holiday in the UK and talking to various distillers that I sort of met around the traps. They're saying, oh, are there many distillers in Australia now? Like, yeah, we've got a couple. And you tell them 700 and they fall off their fucking chair. Like, what?
Yeah, 700 and counting, that's right.
That's it.
We've actually got more distilleries than the US based on population per capita. Mm. And Scotland, I think we're three times as many distilleries as Scotland right now. Mm. So it's, yes, Australia was a powerhouse in the distilling industry back in the day. So, it's interesting times. But let's rip into it. So we have Tim in the bottom corner. We have myself, Mr. Annoyance. We have Todd up in the top. G'day, Todd. And we have Luke. So, Todd, what are you drinking?
I am going to be drinking Overeem tonight.
Oh, it's still on the Overeem?
This is a sherry cask finished in a sherry cask, which is random. But
just for extra jam.
It's quite jammy and quite nice. As you can see, I've knocked it off a bit.
just a bit.
Very nice.
All right, and Luke?
I received, while I was away, a bottle of Island Coast whiskey from the Single Malt Whiskey Club subscription. Right. So these guys, this is sherry cask.
Yep.
Matured for 7 years, 46 ABV. Mm-hmm. These guys are down in Tassie somewhere. So that's what I'm going to be drinking tonight. But I do have some other bits from my trip away that I'll sort of flash up as you go through
the night.
Yeah.
Well, I'm on a quiet little cheeky beer right now from Zigzag Brewery, good mates of mine. Nice little palate refresher. And then I thought, in honor of Mr. Marty Pye from Riverbourne Distillery, mentor, mate, pain in the ass. A few years ago, he gave me this, and we were playing around with a project together called the Mystery Whiskey. And
you're game drinking the Mystery Whiskey, I can tell you.
Well, I didn't like it. I didn't like it.
Well, it's not better in the bottle, has it?
No, I don't know if I like it now, but Marty's released this now, and he released, I think it was on at the Canberra whiskey show, which was last weekend. So I think it's called The Betrayal. So I thought, and apparently it was very popular. So I thought, I'll try it again. So this is The Betrayal from Riverbourne Distillery.
There you go.
Yeah. Anyway, so now we all know what we're drinking. Let's rip into
it. Well, we need to know what Tim's drinking.
Well, look, I've got some rules. I do a little bit of media from time to time. So this is a glass of water, and there's an explanation for that, which is you can't go talking to the press with once you've had a drink. But what I do have here with me, speaking of how long I've been going, this is a little cacao liqueur, which was the very first little batch of cacao liqueur that I did. I've just pulled off the shelf back there. And this one here is about 2007, 2008, is what it's got written on the back of it here, little cherry liqueur. So it's probably about time that I opened those up. But,
yeah.
Today.
It's pretty special.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
I don't think the recipe's changed much since then either.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what age does to it then.
Nothing good, I don't think, but nostalgia.
Of course.
All right. So, well, let's talk about your story, Tim. So, as you said, you've been around for quite some time and established and doing your thing. So what is your thing? And tell us about how you got into it and the whole journey up until now.
Yeah, a friend of mine called James Reed started a little distillery down in Tasmania about 2010 called Old Kempton. Called Redlands, which has now become Old Kempton. When I was starting up, I'm just trying to remember the year, 2008, 2010, somewhere there, because it was once a Tasmanian. And I went down for a couple of weeks to help him out. I think if you go to the distillery now, I helped build the toilet block, but we won't go into that in too much detail. And I couldn't fathom how alcohol was made, this yeast and fermentation and malting. It didn't make sense to me. So I came back to Canberra, and having had mates who had done homebrew, I knew that you couldn't get a good outcome unless you bought a good still. So I spent a bit of money, and I bought probably a little higher spec still than what your average home distiller will do. And from there, just got started. I'm an economist by trade, and lobbyist is probably the better description for what I've done for most of the past 20 years. I've in Canberra represented most of the bad people in the world. There was a time there where I knew I was coming up for a period of unemployment when I was working for the coal-fired power stations and the carbon price was about to be repealed, and that would mean that I no longer had a job involved in that. And so 2014 began the process of going pro. 2015 got the ticket from the ACT government, so the first licensed distillery in Canberra. I think Canberra probably holds the record for the most unlicensed distillers in the country, given the ethnic heritage of it. It's quite a large number of households that have stories about their great uncle that came out to work on the Snowy Mountains scheme and stole some copper from the Snowy Mountains scheme and now have a still underneath their house. But, that was my story. Started just about 5 metres that way in the garage. We left there in 2018, now down the road in an industrial suburb. Expanded pretty quickly there. Things got really busy 2018 through to, well, probably the peak of the cycle in 2023. Now 6 full-time staff, 10 to 20 casuals, depending on what time of the year and what's going on. So, yeah, it's been a fabulous roller coaster ride. For me, a little like you're talking, you're distilling there at the moment, and that's what it was for me. Distilling is mostly sitting around waiting for a pot to boil. And doing the economics and the day job kind of work pretty well together.
Yeah.
So you're able to sit there on the laptop working away whilst...
On that note, I've just got to duck off for a little bit. I'll be back in...
the old snap. Yeah. Anton Parr, yep.
So Crafty is literally doing a spirit run at this very moment because, why not? 8 o'clock on Thursday evening. They're the things that you do as a small... sole trader self.
He decided it was a little bit cold to get up in the morning and he'd just lie there for just a little bit longer, and then it became 12 o'clock. I would expect.
Well, there's a good thing about distilling down here in winter is it helps keep you warm.
Yes.
Helps keep you warm, and I guess your cooling is a lot easier as well.
Yeah. You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Then it freezes.
What? I didn't think alcohol froze.
The cooling water, though.
Cooling water, absolutely.
Yep.
So 10 years in the business would definitely makes you one of the elders of the industry.
Yeah, you'd think I'd have been more successful in growing my business in that time frame, wouldn't you?
Well, there's different definitions of success and growth.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
You could be a Lark. You could be a Sullivan's Cove. You could be a Lime Burners, or you can be a smaller, tighter, more niche entity. I guess that's sort of the route that you've gone, more controlled growth rather than just trying to
Yeah. So when you're starting out your brand, all of the advice is don't geographically locate your business. And I heard that and went, oh, I'm going to geographically locate my business. My mother's family were the first white people to cross the Murrumbidgee here. My father's family ran the first coach line from Queanbeyan. So they're fairly well rooted here. And we're not taking over the world. We're doing our thing. We are the Canberra Distillery, not a Canberra Distillery. Mm-hmm. That's our line. I've rolled that out a couple of times. we've never set out to take over the world. We've been pretty blessed with what we've managed to achieve in that time. The marketing and branding aspect of trying to grow an international brand, that's not my background. That's not my skill. It was not what we set out to achieve. And I'm pretty pleased with where we're at the moment.
Mm. That all that said, looking at your website and doing very rough math on that now, I see 16.
Different products. Oh, gosh, different there's a lot products. More than 16 different products.
Yeah, so what's that? So 16, again, 20, 24, 27 yeah. different products.
Yeah, don't follow me for good business advice because I don't like making the same thing twice. That's a problem. Yeah. So we do have other people that can follow a recipe, but I'm not very good at writing recipes down, which might explain why we never got too far with this cacao liqueur here. But, it's... keeping things interesting, keeping things new, evolving. Because we're not heading out with one brand and seeking global domination, we do need to keep creating some interest, some excitement, collaboration. So we're going to have one before the end of the year, which is our first non-beverage collaboration, which is something pretty interesting. I'll say it's bourbon inspired. I'll go with that. Good. Yep. It's going to be different. It should be right up your alley, Crafty. But, just keeping that new stuff, keeping it going. So we just released an absinthe. Next year we'll have a little pomplemousse on the way. We've got a Calvados, is not a true Calvados, of course. Can't call it that. We've done some other products that come from specific parts of the world. We do a fair bit of gypsy distilling as well. I haven't mentioned that one, but... we come across some interesting recipes. We've developed a few for other places, and we're certainly very much stuck in that wholesale side of the market, not in the full retail side, which I think suits me well, given that I like the production, the making side more than the selling.
Mm.
And it does mean that we get to tinker around with a lot of different things. It does mean that you're handing over your child every time you do it. And so we've had other craft distillers starting up, made their first batch of gin for them. To their particular style and they say to their recipe, but just to adjust that a little bit and help them out with that. And there is a little bit of that, but you have to pretty quickly in business get over that gifting away your child phase.
Mm. But that, even that being said, you've still got plenty of children by the looks of it.
Yeah. The new product side of things, I do enjoy. We have some staff these days that have exceptional skills and have excellent palates, and that also has helped in the last few years as well, because I kind of took a little bit of a transition back out of that, particularly the front-facing stuff over the past couple of years. Short story, I kind of just got a bit tired there through the middle of the pandemic, for want of a better word, and having those people there to fill that gap's been great. Stepping back into it a little bit now this year, but don't have 20 different products. No.
I always find it interesting when you see a distillery that has such a huge range of different products that they're trying to maintain whilst at the same time creating new products all the time as well. What dictates something dropping off? Just it's out of stock, it's gone, or is
it whether I like it or not?
Sick of making really, that now, I don't like it anymore, it's out.
It's mostly up to the things I like and the things I don't. Look, once we've clocked up something that we like and we're keeping, we do make a number of years worth of stock, and we have all you need for that is an unlimited amount of storage, and we seem to have a fair bit of capacity for that at the moment. And so we do make a large volume when we get going, and then we sell it down over time. Just means from a packaging and processing perspective, you can start to acquire that volume that you need to get your marginal costs down. We have products that we keep. We're having a look at that the other day. You know, we've got probably half a dozen products in that list, of, and it's a lot more than, I think it's probably a little over 30 that we actually have for sale. We've got products there, probably half a dozen that we do less than 1,000 bottles per year on. But I like them. We do a barrel-aged Negroni, and we go through about 1,000 litres of that a year. And that's a fairly regular evening tipple for me. It'll be what I'm on after this glass of water. Just to have somebody else make you a barrel-aged Negroni, have it in a bottle and not have to make it, concoct it yourself every night. And it's one of the benefits of owning a distillery is other people making your cocktails for you.
That's it. In talking and working with people like Ben Osborne, Unicorn Spirits and the local Spirit Co., generally he's making things that he likes and he wants to drink, and then he just puts the whole cocktail into a bottle. That's his strategy.
That's it. Well, yeah, Ben used to work just outside here. Ben used to put the silver sparkles into our must liqueur back in the day. And so, I'd like to take some credit there for maybe some of the shine rubbed off on him. Look, Ben's...
A lot of shine.
When you look at the people that have come through the distillery, and you know, all of them have the intention of starting up their own distillery, Ben's been interesting. Like, you know, you sit down and you look at who I thought would have made it through and started their own brand. And Ben's the only one. And, you know, that question of just quite what it is that made Ben different from all of the others, and it is that ability to just turn up and solve a problem, Ben's ability to bounce back every time, because there's just barrier after barrier. And Ben's ability to turn up and respond to all that and go again is, you know, how he's managed to get to where he's at.
You raised a really good point there, Tim, and it's really topical. You know, I actually did a post on the ADA Facebook group yesterday on it. It's a tough game. Having a distillery is a tough game. It's like any small business, isn't it? You've got to have resilience, and you've got to be a MacGyver. You've got to know how to fix things and fix situations and keep moving forward. And when you get knocked down, you got to pick yourself up and keep going, don't you? It can be a slog like any small business.
Yeah, look, I think I got lucky. I caught, 2015, I caught the wave there. So we got a free hit. Bill Lark's liner, rising tide, floats all boats. And that was certainly very true. Where we find ourselves now, though, is very different. And I'll just throw to the economic side of my background and talk about market cycles. And for distillers, we're very much locked into that. And I saw it happening in the United States. Every other year I go to the American Distillers Conference, which I'd highly recommend to anyone. And to sit in a room with 3,000 to 5,000 other distillers, just the volume of content and development you get there. I think it was 2018, Portland, we're in, went on a bus trip out to see a bourbon distillery. And half of the bus were a group of young people who were very aspirational about, they borrowed and begged, borrowed, stole every cent they could to start up a distillery. And the other half were a group of very wealthy people that just wanted to make the world's best whiskey. And just watching what happened through their cycle, where they've gone through this phase of overproduction, they've had an enormous amount of consolidation within their industry through the pandemic, just as we're building up. They've consolidated now down, and I was there September last year, and you can see them coming out of that cycle now, that a lot of people are going broke in the US just before the pandemic, and now they all seem to have adjusted to find the right scale, the right volume, those that are doing their own local craft stuff, those that are seeking to take over the world. And so, the Australian market's going through that cycle as well. And the cycle is known as Porter's model of market equilibrium. And as an economist, we know exactly what the cycle looks like. The only thing we don't know is the time frame in which it happens, right? The only piece that you guys really want to know is how long is this going to take. And so for us, we're in a phase now, an enormous volume of distillers in the market, quite a few of them now. At the same point in the cycle where through the pandemic, we got a free hit because there was the government assistance. There was also the supply chain barriers, which stopped a lot of imported product coming in. And you can see that the big brands had maybe 30% of their shelf space was free. Emails from large brand names repeatedly asking, we just want a pallet of stuff. We don't care what it is. You know, don't care what the price is. We didn't service those requests because we knew that if we did that, we were going to break that relationship with our mum and dad independent bottle shops. And so we didn't service it. And now we're, you know, we can see that we're on that the other side of it. The free hit is gone. We now have a really large volume of brands, and a lot of them, as I go around, I was in Perth just this past weekend and a number of brands there. Now, trying to get shelf space now is really difficult. It's going to get increasingly difficult. And we enter the cycle we're in now is it's difficult to know whether we're in the delusion phase or just on the other side of that peak. I suspect we're probably still heading up that curve. When I say we know what the curve looks like, if you want to see what the curve looks like, it's exactly the same as what happened to tulips in 1776. The graph hasn't changed shape since the great tulip crisis in the Netherlands 400 years ago.
I remember that.
You were there, weren't you, Crafty?
No, I wasn't there, but I studied at school.
Yeah, and so at the moment, I'm also working in the building industry, and we talk a lot about the bullwhip effect. And the bullwhip effect is something that we'll see in a few years' time, which is, I'm talking about that pandemic cycle there. The bullwhip effect explains that a small change at the retail end leads to a disproportionate change at the producer end. And we saw that small uplift in consumption patterns as people stayed at home, they consumed more at home, they consume more higher end. Now they're switching back, and that takes a lag effect for to flow through to us as producers. And for those that are a little step back, certainly as a manufacturing business doing gypsy distilling, it takes a number of years for that to come back through to us as well. That's because bottle shops over order, and it takes a while for their customers to adjust. They order through a wholesaler, their wholesaler over orders, then the producer at our end, we see a very significant increase in our orders. And by the time that flows through to the retail perspective, the retail customers have changed their consumption pattern and everyone is oversupplied in the supply chain. And so we will see that play out over the course of the next couple of years. And for those, you know, I had some advice from when I was in the US 2018, which was 50% of your startup funds should be spent on marketing and advertising. Now, I'm not sure I've spent a dollar on marketing or advertising in 10 years, but if you're starting out now, I would suggest you're probably looking at 80 to 90% of your budget should be allocated to marketing and branding and just a small percentage to actually production.
Wow. I would add to that, though.
I would say it's fine to spend money on marketing and branding, but make sure it's a dollar well spent, because you do see people drop 30, 40,000 and create a brand, and it just comes out and you look at it and go, that's, you've just bought a brand and it's got no authenticity to it.
Yep.
So yeah, spend your dollars wisely, do your research. That's my advice.
Yeah. And look, I'm a long way from marketing and branding. And I've learned some concepts, and you mentioned there the full range of products we've got. We are these days a branded house. Everything comes in under the one brand, but we did flirt with being a house of brands there for a while. Over the years, shed them. Just this past week, I've had so there's two distilleries that I've come across that are looking to sell, and they think that their brand has some value, and that's just not the case. That's not the cycle we're in at the moment. So yeah, marketing, branding, it's not my area of specialty. I know I should spend more money on it, and I don't.
But then you've got the challenge of, you build your brand, you spend your money on your brand, or you spend your money on actually producing and putting down barrels and having the stock aging and maturing, rather than just not and have it. Is there much point in having an established brand with fantastic marketing if you don't have product to sell?
Yeah, that's very true. And certainly through till probably 2022, our challenge was all about production, which was trying to train up people, trying to upscale. Every time you increase your capacity, you go from a you know, from a 100 litre still to a 500 litre still into two 500 litres now, at two 1,000 litre stills and I think it's a 1,500 litre still. And, you know, each time you go through that step up and you go through the step up in training staff, and it's hard increasing production. And if somebody had told me that you needed a distillery that's of the size that it is now, oh, it would have been a lot easier to start out with that. But, of course, you don't know that as you go through. But you know, on the production side of things, you know, for anyone looking to start out today, my tip would be pick a round bottle. Round bottles are just so much easier to handle, to box, to put down a packaging line. Use a screw cap because screw caps never fail. I know corks are deeply sexy, but you can't buy a machine to put a screw cap on and to put a you can't buy a machine to put a cork on cheaply. And the complexities then in mechanizing that, my cork's problem, mate. You've got to spend a lot of money to get a machine that'll handle a square bottle with a cork.
Says the man who uses corks and square bottles and hand labels and has decided, decided wax is gone. I'm finished with wax. I'm arguing with my wife about this right now. She's going, but wax is good. And I'm going, no, it melts at the markets during summer and it goes solid in winter. It's a pain in the ass. It cracks. It crazes.
Ages gone. Keep looking good.
Bring on Stelvons, I say.
Yeah, I agree.
Look, it wax is beautiful. It's got that all of those things that marketers, you know, if you go and see a marketer, they'll tell you you should have wax seals. And, yeah, but no one ever switches from, no one that does screw caps goes to corks. People that have corks do go to screw caps.
If you're not going to do wax then, Crafty, that's intrigued me now. What would be your alternative for keeping the cap on during transport? And will you go for a shrink wrap? Will you go for
a nice looking cork with a wooden top and maybe a plate and then a shrink?
Jones and Smith does it pretty well.
Jones and Smith does it very well, actually. Yeah, they do. Yeah, and these are the sort of questions you. When you first start a distillery, you don't think about it, right? As you go along in your journey, isn't it, Tim? You start to uncover. I remember Bill McHenry gave me some really great advice right at the start. He said, Crafty, don't go and print a lot of labels. He says, it may cost more to get smaller runs, but do it because you don't know where you're going with your designs. You don't know where you're going with the labels. And the last thing you want is just boxes and boxes of labels that you'll never, ever use and you're paid for. And it's a good point. It's an absolutely good point. I got to go check my spirits, guys. I was at 65 a little while ago. Take a stab. What do you reckon it would be now? It was 65 ABV. So that was about half an hour ago, I reckon, maybe.
62
and a half. 62, Tim, what do you reckon?
62 and a half.
I've never been involved in a spirit run, so I would have no idea. So I'm going
to defer. You should be able to smell it from there. Can't you smell the ABV? Something.
Hold on. Oh, 61.7. Ooh, hang on.
If it comes back 61.7, I'm going to cry.
If it comes back 61.7, I'm asking for fucking proof.
Yeah.
I want to see the reading.
And compare, show us.
So I've just been talking about setting up new distilleries. I've just come back from a holiday in the UK, and I went up to Scotland for a couple of days. And, okay, tell us what was it?
So what did you say, Tim?
62 and a half.
62 and a half. Todd?
Mine was 62. Ooh. 63. Ooh. 64. Okay, it hasn't dropped very fast then.
Hey, turn the temp up, mate. Turn the temp up.
It's maxed out. That's good. That's slow.
And it's probably cold there as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Actually, it's not too bad tonight. Be about 12 degrees in the shed right now. I'd say.
But yeah, talking about setting up a new distillery, I went to the Port of Leith Distillery, and people can jump onto the Facebook page and see I did the tour and posted photos and all that sort of stuff there.
And that's a vertical distillery, isn't it?
That's a 8-story vertical distillery, purpose-built building, purpose-built everything. They're literally suspending fermenters from the ceiling on one level. They've got these two massive stills in there with concrete slabs suspended above, like 3 stories up. Cost them tens of millions of dollars to build. Nobody has that money except for the Scots to do that sort of a thing. How do you think that would be feasible in Australia to go that far out with a new distillery build? And do you think they would survive if they tried to do it here?
There is the capacity for that. As somebody that bought shares in Lark Distilling shortly before they bought Sheen Distillery, and their share price went from $5 to 50 cents, had to turn a good amount of money into one-tenth the amount of money. So take share advice from me. They went, that business model is not unlike what you're talking about. The paper said $50 million purchase price for Sheen. In that model, whereby you are producing a large volume of whiskey specifically targeted at that Chinese market, I think that there is a business model that can work there. Building your brand there, and certainly Tasmania is doing that. It's not me.
It's a big risk. It's a big ask, and time will tell in a few years' time what their actual whiskey tastes like. It'll be an interesting one. We've had a couple of questions come in. So bear in mind, here we go. So Hammo is just commenting on that. Bear in mind, Scotch is most likely Scotland's primary export. Wouldn't mind betting that the government might assist with subsidies.
Yeah, that always helps.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Moving.
Talk to the Victorians about the government assistance. The Victorian government are huge supporters of the Victorian distillers industry. To the point, I was talking to a distiller and I go, "Nice garden." He goes, "Yeah, grant money." And then I pointed to something else. He goes, "How'd you afford that?" He goes, "Oh, grant money for that one as well." I was like, freaking hell. So New South Wales,
he's frozen.
I'm on the ground money all the time.
I have to be very appreciative of my support from the ACT government as a small tourism operator. It's certainly we've been supported by the ACT government as well.
Yeah.
So come back in a year's time, Crafty, and you'll see our new wheelchair accessibility entrance for the distillery.
Very nice. Very nice.
We'll do that. Now, a couple more questions came in. Earlier on, talking about the economic side, do you think the pandemic has helped people and businesses to build their resolve and learn how to pivot?
No, I think it was quite the opposite. I think people thought, go through that process. And I mentioned the building industry before that I worked with. We've seen the building industry go through this cycle where there was an enormous boom and then there was a cash flow problem. And that's what happens. People think that because they increase sales through the pandemic, that's because of their marketing and their branding and their unique, wonderfully flavored gin. But it turns out it's not. It was the entire market shuffling up, and now as the entire market shuffles down, who wins out of that cycle is going to be those that are best at pursuing market share, not about pursuing margin. And that's the cycle that we're about to enter into now. So, no, I think quite the opposite happens. It teaches us to be teaches us to think that it is our own actions that have caused our success when it wasn't. It was market dynamics.
So do you think that the distilling industry will see a significant reduction in the number of distilleries? Will shrink from that 750 odd down significantly?
We're going to see a significant... We haven't hit the top of that curve yet, I don't think. I think we're in the delusion phase. We'll crack 1,000. We might get to 1,300 or 1,400. I think there's quite a few more people that are ambitious with their money and going to have a go at it. That tail end of what's coming on through. But yeah, we will consolidate back to probably less, to certainly fewer than what we have here. When you look at those market cycles, if you look at automotive, 100 odd years ago, there was more than 1,000 automotive brands in the US alone. And then we ended up by the late 90s, effectively 4 car brands globally. And now there's more than 1,000 car brands within China alone again. And so industries go through those cycles. And in a true unregulated cycle, you end up with 2 companies. You know, for us in Australia, aviation is 2 companies. Supermarkets are 2 companies. Banks are disputably 4. And so if left alone, the industry would consolidate back to something like that. But, yeah, we're not quite at the peak of that cycle before we come down the other side.
Right. So we've got a good few years-ish as a guesstimate before we would start seeing more of what the brewing industry is going through at the moment.
Yeah.
And every other day there's a brewery closing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great time to buy stainless steel at the moment.
Yeah,
you look at the positive for everything. There's a lot of fermenters available at the moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think what's happening in the brewing world right now, it's sad what's happening. You know, brewery closing every week, but in the craft distillation space, we're a few points behind that, but there's definitely a lot of pressure on. And my own personal opinion is those guys that just boomed through the pandemic or pre-pandemic and then just went out there and borrowed and got investors and that, and you know, they built for the future when their future wasn't there. It was, it's cycles and things change, as Tim said. So there's a lot of people overcapitalized, sitting on a lot of equipment, got to pay it, and huge staff bills. And so there's a lot of hunkering down in the industry, I believe. I also explained it to someone the other day. I think it's the rise of the rise of the mammals. You know, there's a lot of dinosaurs out there, a lot of big operations, but there's mammals out there, and you know, the mammals are nimble, and you know, they can pivot and they can hunker down. I think you're going to see survival of the mammals, but I think you're going to see.
Are you talking about middle-aged man in lycra?
Yeah. Well, also, I'm curious, Crafty, are you a mammal or are you a cockroach? Because a cockroach will outlive everyone.
I was going to say a reptile, but Jesus, all right. Call me a cockroach if you will. I've been called worse.
You like to wallow in your own filth.
I've seen your caravan.
Yeah,
the yeast factory. Anyway,
right along. Anyway, there was another question that came in. Going back, also talking about bottles. How about the flip style cap of the Grolsch bottle?
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I do not see that more. I love those things. You get that really satisfying.
Yeah, yeah. Look, this person must have a degree in marketing or something, because they're right. It's not how my brain works. I like going to that bar that has the $500,000 chandelier, and I'm prepared to pay whatever price the whiskey is in that bar, because I want to sit in front of an open fire with an enormous Chesterfield and a chandelier. But as a businessman myself, I am not the businessman that will invest in the Grolsch swing top lid. I am much leaner. If you have to borrow, you can't afford it. You have a plan to know how every dollar is going to be spent and returned. But so full credit to those people that go for the Grolsch screw cup. That's for the swing top.
Are they that more expensive?
Well, look, if you go down that path, there was one I saw recently. They'd got their shipment of custom bottles from China. It's a beautiful, tall bottle that had a habit of snapping. They couldn't post them. They couldn't, once they were full, they could only go 4 bottles high, because otherwise the necks on the bottles would break. So, you know, it's a risk.
Speaking of custom bottles, I think I've shown this one before. I met these guys from Burley at the Sydney.
That's a beautiful bottle, isn't it?
Which is absolutely gorgeous bottle. They've got the orange for the citrus. They've got a green for the cucumber, and I think there's another color as well. But that's your marketing budget there, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that is a beautiful bottle. Mm. Yeah, it's a beautiful bottle. You know, whether it fits on the bar shelf and where it gets placed up. The lovely blokes, Wes and Co. at Prohibition, we're chatting to them in a market in 2017 or so, and that big square bottle that's got Prohibition written across the back, a marketer's dream. And then every time you see that in a bar, it's turned sideways and you have no idea what it is.
Yep, yep.
So, yeah, just how that works, again, round bottle. Fits.
Yeah.
Case not in beautiful, point. It's not sexy. Gosh, it works.
Case in point here on my shelf is side on. So,
yep.
Amongst everything, you can't see it.
The lark
That's bottle. Your lark bottle.
Yeah.
Interestingly, that they've gone for that that sort of the hip flask style, I call that. But yeah, you're exactly right. On the shelf, it's disappeared.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now that you're below a third on that bottle, you should finish it off.
Well, I'm not allowed to finish that one off. I'm not allowed to. Crafty will kill me.
That's no, you can. Right. Yeah, don't let it go to waste. Not now. That was the anniversary bottle. Yeah, the collaboration one. Yeah, no, drink it, mate. Drink it. Yeah. Hey, on that bottle, very, very interesting. I was talking to a bottle shop down the rocks. And I was saying, what's your biggest seller? Australian product. And he said, what is that noise? He said it was the lark. And he said part of the reason it was is the cruise liners come in and they like the bottle because it's easy to pack. It's a flat bottle.
Oh.
I had not thought of that one.
I had not thought of that either. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thing. And I bet the guy who picked that bottle design at Lark didn't think about that. But interesting. He said, we sell a lot of it to cruise liners.
Yep.
Right.
So there we are.
There you go.
Well, they're a long way. If we get a cruise liner, drops in at our cellar door, that whole climate change thing has gone horribly wrong.
We've got much bigger issues at that point.
We do. Look, even after the zombie apocalypse, everyone will still want to get their buzz on, and that's why we're safe. We're just fine.
Yeah.
That's it. Distiller will take over the world. Zombie apocalypse fund here. I've got my silver rounds in my safe below. Actually, no, I don't. Nobody knows that, so shush.
Yeah, I'm not telling you my plan. I've got a plan. It's not to go to Crafty's house either.
No.
I wouldn't go there.
No.
Yep. Question I got for you, Tim. So what excites you as far as product development?
Oh, product development. So just before the pandemic, I did have a play around with doing with a whole bunch of tonics, and they're sitting in a box just over there in the corner. I'm going to get back to those ones. I mentioned one before, and I can't mention what it is because somebody might work out how to make it before Christmas time, which is when we're going to launch ours. But it's an endless supply of ideas and things. And that's, you know, part of going to the US every year is every time you walk into a distillery, even after 10 years, it doesn't matter where I go, you have a chat to somebody and you learn something new. And I did in that trip to September last year. New product-wise, I think, you know, rum is something that, when I became a distiller, I built a wooden boat. I restored a vintage motorbike. Turns out I don't like boats or motorbikes. I started a distillery because, again, I like tinkering around in a shed. And I do like drinking, but I didn't like rum when I started the journey. And I have learnt to like rum. And then I found bourbon and I learnt to like that even more. And so I think rum for us in Australia is that product that continues to be very marginal, you know, 55-year-old bloke in Lycra, the mammals that Crafty was referring to there before. So narrow bearded demographic, and it shouldn't be. Yeah, the rest of the world, it is an exciting product that young people drink, then you can talk about and hear it. Just it's so I think as an industry, and I know all of the distillers talk about rum's coming. Rum's coming, guys. It's coming. It's going to have its renaissance in Australia too.
Yeah. Mm. Or as Scotty Fitzsimmons says, the rum-naissance.
Rum-naissance, yeah.
He's been saying the rum-naissance for about 8 years. So
yeah.
But there is. There is some awesome stuff out now. There's a lot more out now, and people are going in different directions in their rum, which is really exciting.
Yep. And the look on that cycle front, so your rum hasn't had its rum nascence, and you always hear people talking about whiskey has peaked and it's going to come off, which is a story that I think has been running since about the mid-1980s. And it's very difficult to see an end of the whiskey cycle. You know, we saw the vodka cycle peak sort of 2011, 2014, and then track back down. We've seen the gin cycle peak, which I think was probably, retrospect will say, Christmas 23. And the rum cycle, you know, it'll get started eventually. But that whiskey cycle still has a very long way to go, given the demographic base that it has. It is an 18 to whatever age group. These days, increasingly, it is a young female drink. They're attempting to own that space. And you can see that in the data that comes through from the big guys. And you can see that in how their advertising is pivoting away from looking at blokes with beards smoking cigars in front of Chesterfields to a much more feminine and younger demographic.
Yeah.
We've definitely seen that female focus in the whiskey demographic with advertising and some of the big players. There was notably a very a large whiskey ad campaign.
The Jane Walker campaign that they retracted straight away, and then
Was it the Glenlivet maybe? I'm going to have to find it now. But yeah, that was a very female focus campaign saying that whiskey isn't just for men. It is for women. And you're allowed to drink it and enjoy it and drink it better than men.
Is there an ad somewhere? Whiskey almost as good as rum? Isn't that a slogan too?
There is an old advertisement
for that somewhere.
I didn't just
make that one up. It's at least a few hundred years old.
Now, speaking of rum, in a few weeks' time, we do actually have a big rum episode coming up, don't we, Crafty?
19th of September. He's gone off to do something. He's magic, yeah, that boy.
It just disappears. It's amazing. So who have we got, Todd?
From Barbados somewhere. Foursquare.
Yeah. So 19th of September, we've got Foursquare, and I can't remember his name for the life of me now. Who's Foursquare, Crafty?
Richard Seal. The bombastic, opinionated, highly technical guru of rum.
Well, I think the most interesting rum I've come across, speaking of Barbados, there, amidst the guys from 40 Leagues Distillery in the US once, and they age their rum in what I'll describe as very large condoms that go over the barrel entirely, and then they drop the barrels down 14 leagues, a distance at which there is constant temperature year-round, and they age their rum underwater.
Wow.
In the ocean.
In the ocean, yes. Somewhere. Yeah. 40 Leagues is the name of the brand. Oh,
yeah, right. I'm going to have to Google that. Now, that sounds like a really interesting concept because, to my understanding, the whole idea of going into a barrel is you've got the barometric changes that are drawing liquid in and out of the barrel to extract the tannins and the flavor, whatever, from the wood, and that is a good chunk of the aging process. If you're under a constant pressure and constant temperature at all times in a sealed condom.
Where are you getting all that penetration from?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, obviously there's a action going on, but what is it?
So they do lose. I did taste the rum, and I'm not saying that it has a rubbery taste to it, but it is different.
Come on, go back to
me. It is different. And they do know that they lose they have a large share of the whiskey that does exit rum that exits the barrel. And they still have an angel share, which is 10 or 15%. And they do say that once it's exited the barrel, that it does acquire that flavor. So there's no doubt that there is some form of penetration back in between the barrel and the liquid on the inside. But yeah,
he's making a statement.
Seven fathoms.
Thank you.
I missed the highly technical conversation. Thanks. That's where I'm at.
You're upside down.
You're upside down. 61 point something.
There you go. So just to...
I'm close.
I'm gonna post. Oh wow, that's an amazing website. Holy shit! I need to figure out how they built that because that's sexy as.
they had some cash.
I'm just posting a link into the chat. So Crafty, we were talking about Seven Fathoms rum that is aged at the bottom of the ocean. I'm trying to find more information about that process because I thought that the lack of pressure change.
No, pressure out. Yeah, they don't leak. But they put it into some sort of condom, as you said.
It's 42 feet below sea level.
So it's actually sealed. They tie the condom and drop it down. Wow.
So we escort the rum in an American white oak bourbon cask to a secret location off the Cayman coast, anchored at 42 feet. And exactly 7 fathoms deep.
Across that.
That's a lot of pressure.
Our handcrafted rum enjoys underwater currents that rock the spirit gently and constant temperatures like nowhere on land.
There you go. It's the tidal motion that would be making that
rocking and rolling. There you go.
We might be just heading back to more of those marketing claims and just how important marketing is.
Yeah. Now, rum
it's like
was
sticking it on a fishing boat and sailing it out to sea for 6 months.
Yep. Yeah. Sure. Actually, what they're doing is going out and dropping off a barrel of rum, and they're picking up a barrel of what was it?
Salty water.
Whatever's cruising up and down the coast of Barbados between America and that other Latin American country.
I was going to say that they basically just they tie the barrel over the side, drop it down, 1, 2, 3, pull it up and go, right, okay, we've done it.
And maybe a couple of kilos of cocaine in the bag.
What's the line?
It helps with the advertising budget.
What's the line? Never let the truth get in front of a good story, of course.
Oh, absolutely not.
Exactly.
Yeah. Angel fish share.
Yes. So rum was one of the original currencies of our Australia. There was a great
the
Rum Rebellion. Definitely interesting to go back and listen to. Do you think we'll head back to a rum-based economy? Is the world heading that far back?
Well, look, Eureka Stockade was also largely a rum-based rebellion too. People forget about that. And go and have a look at a chap called John Joseph. He was an emancipated African-American slave who was central to the Eureka Stockade. One day I'm going to write a movie script about him. But I hope we don't cycle back. You know, we've got to get through the Bitcoin phase before we go back to using rum as our means of fiat exchange.
There's a bit more. Rum's a bit more tangible than Bitcoin, though. And if we end up in the zombie apocalypse, I think your Bitcoin's going to be about as useful as crafty.
No, I'm going to add to that. I think that's the currency would be coconuts. See if you make the connection on that one.
No?
No, it doesn't. Does anybody? No?
Right. I'm lost.
You've got a lovely bunch of coconuts.
It's an inside joke in my head, and it's just what's going on in America right now. I follow American politics closely.
Yes. There's a lot to unpick over there at the moment. I think that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, we digress. Let's go in a completely different direction. So I would like to know, Tim, so I think you pretty well answered this, to be honest. So you're highly influenced by what's going on in America, less so than what's going on in Europe, I would say. So so when you go to the US, and you said you go on a quite a regular basis, do you go with like a set objective, like I want to learn about such and such, or I want to see this particular person or understand this process? Or do you just go and you're open to whatever experience?
No, I just, I only book my hotel accommodation once I've landed in a city, right? I'm going to be in, So, look, I turn up and go with the flow. And, look, America is a lovely and interesting place. And the first time I went, I ended up in America's largest Baijiu manufacturing facility, so Chinese rice whiskey, and learned the entire process for that, and then came back here sorghum is what they're using, managed to make a little bit of Baijiu myself, which I don't know if you guys have had a crack at it. Yeah, rice whiskey, Baijiu, it's not my cup of tea, but it needs a certain amount of soup. I think I got the right amount of soup in it. This last trip, I ended up, there's a distillery that is a cross between a distillery and a Cirque du Soleil performance. And late one night, ended up drinking with the lovely ladies from that performance and some other people. And look, gosh, there's a lot of fun to be had with American distillers. I'll leave that story there.
No, I'm gonna tell you my little story, Tim. So I'm big on whiskey terroir and understanding, is it a real thing or not? And it goes back to my love of Brook Laddie early 2000. And Mark Rainier, who was Brook Laddie, moved on to Waterford, and Waterford have taken terroir to a whole different level. So anyway, I have a very close relationship with Waterford Distillery. And last week I woke up one morning and I went, I'm going to go to Waterford. Can't afford it. Don't think Andrew and my wife's going to like it, but I'm going to go to Waterford because I need to go to Waterford. I need to, right? I've sort of been lately thinking about why do I do what I do? And a big part of why I do what I do is because I just love the creativity and I love the learning aspect of it. So I'm going to Waterford in October. I've planned a 2.5 week holiday in Ireland. I'm staying at Waterford Distillery for 3 days, which is awesome. But apart from that, I've got nothing else planned. And all I intend to do is trip around distilleries and breweries and bars in Ireland. And that's going to be an awesome trip, which is very much like what
Yeah, no, that's right. I'm learning by doing. Yeah, how does an engine work? You pull it apart and work it out. On that terroir front, one thing I will say that, 2020 for us in Canberra was annus horribilis. We had dust storms and bushfires, and it was a deeply unpleasant environment. All the whiskey we had down that year, that January, it got covered in about an inch of, probably a centimetre, I should say, of dust that came off Lake George, and the irony that it wasn't a lake, but I'm pretty sure I can taste that dust in any whiskey that was put down. That stuff that was older than that was fine. The stuff that, of course, came after it was fine. But that summer, the stuff we put down in the winter of 2019, yeah, I can taste Annus Horribilis.
Hmm. Wow, that's going to be a good release. I like the name.
Yeah. Yeah. It's dusty and it's hard to consider. Yeah, it's anyway, that's what it is. You put it in a barrel, you wait and see what happens.
So what do you think, if it does come out not to your liking?
I gotta go, guys.
What do you do with it? You've obviously got a lot of it. What do you do with it?
Yeah, we've got a really nice whiskey liqueur.
Mm.
Which is the spice from equivalent of what you do with whiskey. Yeah, yeah. Add a couple of other herbs and spices and a little bit of sugar syrup, and you serve it as a cocktail.
Yeah, right. I did actually I came across something similar to that today. A whiskey that was not not to the taste of the distiller, and they thought, yeah, what I can't sell it. I don't want to sell it as it is. What can I do with it? And they're making it into something that will be quite Christmassy. A lot of spices and a bit of cream in there and a bit of milk, and it's an entirely different beast to the underlying spirit that wasn't good enough.
You never throw
that's something we haven't done. I did buy the kit to make a cream whiskey, and we've never made a cream whiskey. We should do that. It's a good idea. Mm. Yeah, well, 2020 whiskeys are they're still around. I haven't worked out. That's a really good idea. A little sonic homogenizer that I bought a few years back. Cool. That is a fun tool to play around with.
I'll be quite happy to taste it for you.
Yep, absolutely.
There you go. You're down to what? 60.
Mate, 60, you're going to be there till breakfast.
No. I'm still in the hearts.
You doing the spirit run or
This is quite a deep cut. Because of the mash bill. So this particular mash bill, Tim, there's got a percentage of chocolate malt in there, and chocolate malt comes out big time at the end of the hearts cut. That's my experience. So it's there.
Well, that's a good segue into another question for you, Tim, in terms of experimentation within your distillery and within your massive product range. You've obviously experimented with a lot of different things. Tell us about your yeast experimentation over the years.
Played around with wine yeast, champagne yeast. Champagne yeast are always ones that I'm rather partial to. Over the past couple of years, though, I've stepped out of that, and we have a couple of distillers these days. So we have gone back to, we work with our good friends here in Canberra at Benspoke, who help us out there with wash. So we don't need all of the kit there to prep that. It comes to us yeasted and warm and all ready to go. And all we need to do is nurse it through the next couple of weeks.
Mm.
Nice.
Well, certainly Benspoke make an absolutely cracking beer.
Yeah. Look back onto that starting out business one. They have been very good to us. We've actually just launched another product with them. We converted their stout back into a spirit, modestly aged spirit, which has been an interesting little project. But, having those relationships with, I'll describe them for us as the big end of town, has certainly been important. That casual advice that you get from somebody that has been around the industry longer than I have is invaluable.
Mm. Now, that
100% agrees.
Is that released now, that stout, or is that coming
up? Yeah, it's
up?
Called Descendant. You'll find it on the Benspoke website.
Okay, not on your website?
Probably. I'm pretty sure it is on our website. There we go. I remember that. It's called Descendant. Stout distilled, then 3-4 months back in stout barrels that it came out of. So it doesn't quite fit into any particular characteristic, any particular existing style. Give us another couple of years and there'll be something, you know, a little bit longer in a barrel and it'll be a little closer to what you'd describe as a whiskey style. Give us 2 more years before we get there.
Ian pipes up with any way chocolate malt can be used in a rum production or pre-cast to mature rum in.
Ian knows this shit. Ian comes on all the time.
Yeah, and absolutely. Give it a go.
Like, I don't know, but it's like Ian knows this shit. Ian's fishing.
Chocolate malt in rum. So, Crafty, have you tried that
yet? No, but I'm fascinated, absolutely fascinated by the concept of crossing over whiskey to rum, rum to brandy, whiskey to brandy. There are ways to cross over, right? There's definitely ways to cross over. It's just you can't call it rum or whiskey or brandy.
Yeah.
So the concept.
Call it a rusky?
Well, I'll give you a good example. So Nathan from Baker Williams in Mudgee, he had grain spirit and he had grape spirit, and he accidentally mixed them up. And it was the biggest fuck up. Biggest fuck up, right? That's what he said, right? And he kept the vessel with the mix, and every time he walked past it, the story is he kicked it and was like, fuck, you know, fuck, fuck. You know, how did I do that thing, right? And then one day he tasted it and he went, whoa, that's interesting. So it was grape and grain, right? And he released it as a product called Wildcard. Do you remember Wildcard, Tim, when it came out? This is back in... Oh, Jesus, this would be back in about 2018, maybe.
2018, somewhere around there it came out.
Yeah, and it was a really interesting product. Is it something you would drink all the time? No, not at all, definitely not. But it had the grape characteristics, and it definitely had the grain characteristics. So the concept of what Ian was saying there is, yeah, it's very doable, very, very doable.
So, look, you just reminded me of one thing, that bushfire 2020, all of the grapes in our region were lost through bushfire smoke. And the winemakers were saying, we can't make it, it tastes terrible. And I said, oh, come on, you know, give it a crack. I'd love to taste it. And then I did taste their wine, and smoke-affected wine does taste like licking an ashtray. But we got some. We got some wine juice. We got 400 litres of it. And we fermented it using a rum yeast. Ooh, wine, smoked wine. Fermented with rum yeast and distilled as a rum, tastes like a peated rum.
Oh, wow.
It is, I will say, delicious. What we ended up putting it had a bit too long in a new American oak barrel, and it went a bit overly oaked, and we didn't have a quantity that would ever be commercially viable. But if there is ever a bushfire-affected region, wine region in the country again, I know exactly what I'm going to do.
Yeah, wow. That's interesting.
Cool. That's cool. Ian,
very cool. That is certainly having a brain fart idea and making it work. And reminding
The joys of hearing the story, you can do those
of kissing a stranger.
Yep. So the other interesting thing I learned out of that process was that because I'm accustomed to fermenting with brewers and they are very, very clean, and winemakers as fermenters are very agricultural.
Hey, Todd, there's a name
for it. Survey sample of one, I will admit.
Very agricultural whiskey.
We're not dirty. We're agricultural.
Yeah, you sell that to Kevin.
I'm gonna go check, guys.
Right. I guess it's the advantage for brewers that they ferment every week and winemakers do it once a year, but It's different.
That's it. You can, I'm not sure whether you've ever been to Crafty's Shed, but it's an experience in
mustiness,
cultures. It's a mix of cultures, and talking cultures in a yeasty sense.
It's not that bad.
So Ian does say that a peated rum sounds yum.
Yes, look, it's an absolute cracker. If the world combines to give some winemaking region a bad year, then that certainly works. Look, on that culture front, because we mentioned Baijiu there, that's the interesting process that Baijiu goes through, because you start with sorghum and you need a mold to convert the sorghum to effectively peat the sorghum, and then your yeast eats the mold. It's an interesting, it's a fun process, and it's also a dry crack at it. And it is the lowest yielding thing I have ever made. Commercially, I'm not sure how anybody's ever cracked it to make it commercially.
There you go. Well, there is a Australian commercial rice whiskey, and I will give him a little plug.
Yep.
Dusty Barrel.
Yep.
So Dusty Barrel has made Australia's first rice whiskey. He's been kind enough to send us a couple of samples and been waiting for us to all get together again so we can taste them along with the new make, the neutral. Ooh, is made from it there as well. So we'll in a future episode, when we've got all three of us sitting here in my little shed, we will crack those open and have a cheeky taster of them. I'm looking forward to that one. They've been sitting here waiting for us to get together in a room, and we just have to.
We do need to have Dusty Barrel back on again for a. Yes. Now that they're actually a producer of whiskey and not just a maker of.
Indeed. It is available to buy. Jump on to, I'll post the website into the chat as well. So where to from here for Canberra Distillery? What's the next few years look like for you?
Yeah, look, the next few years are a little bit of lock and load. The right thing for us to do is to go to a full retail premise, open a bar, a restaurant, the craft brewing model, that bespoke model, for want of a better term. Mm-hmm. The problem is it's just not something that I aspire to own. And so it would be the right business decision to do that. But what we are going to do instead is we're going to upgrade our facility in Canberra. We've spent a bit of money on stills. We've got to lay things out nice so we can have some classrooms. Just make it a better customer experience when they come to town, and hopefully continue to craft out that space for us here as our local market, and gain a little bit of market share elsewhere in the country slowly, and continue to work on that wholesale side of things. So the Gypsy Distilling, what I call corporates, those other custom products, to build on those, on that base, so that when we get to the other side of this cycle, that we're all set to go again.
Right. Awesome. Now, actually, that's raised an interesting question for me. And if you don't mind sort of explaining the process of engaging you as a Gypsy distiller, how does that look from your side, and what tips could you give someone who is thinking, that's the route that I want to take in finding their Gypsy partner?
Yep. So there's two ways of going about it. The really simple way is you tell us quite what you want your gin, give us a couple of samples, give us a style board, a mood board, and we'll produce a gin. We'll give you the recipe at the end of it. You buy X amount of product off us as your first run. And if anyone's starting out at the moment, I would strongly encourage you to go to one of your local crafts and ask them to create your brand, create your logo, do all your artwork, get your bottle design done, get all of that done, and then go out and sell it. If you can sell it, then you can start looking at investing in capital equipment. And so, yeah, that model is certainly one that over the last few years is there's a number of brands out there that no one, of course, likes you talking about it, but it's quite all right. We're fine with that. Happy to do that. I'll sell you a still on the way through as well, if you like. Everything's for sale. And so, happy to share the recipe. And if you want us to continue to make it for you so that you can spend all of your time selling, which is what you should be doing, happy to do that as well. And for us, you know, our guys, you know, we all enjoy that because when you're given the artistic license to create a new gin and someone, you know, here's my thing, we want a bit of this in it, or we want, you know, the taste of tangerine or whatever it is you want, yep, we can crack that. You know, it's a great chance then to talk about all the different ways in which you can make it. You know, do you want to go down the craft model where everything goes in the pot and you've got a lot of cleaning and care? Or do you want to go down the other path where it is compound method and it's highly consistent and repeatable, relatively slightly cheaper cost? You know, all those options. So, but for a start out, from a business perspective, it's the right model at the moment.
Mm. And when it comes to the cost implications of that, obviously every project, every brand, every brew is going to be different. How does the pricing on that sort of a thing work?
We price it on a per bottle basis. Minimum order is usually a couple of thousand. We'll do, we'll create your recipe with a bit of a fixed cost there and a couple of thousand bottles at a very affordable wholesale price. And then with the hope that, you will sell those quickly and we'll roll through the next couple of orders and we'll keep going. We can do it on a, so that's the fixed price model. We can do it on the cost recovery model, and a few people think that they can save themselves a dollar or two by, we'll just charge you per hour for distillers and per hour, per still run, we'll charge you this price. You're better off going with the fixed price model. We can lock that in. You can lock that in. We do restrict people on a few things. One is that bottle variations, we limit them on the type of bottle they can have, because it needs to be able to go down our kit.
Of course.
And all of which I think are business decisions that I learned through making errors 10 years ago has arrived at what we're at. But then once they've cracked that, then they can head off and design and import a bottle like the Burley gin bottle there.
The investment that they've made in that bottle is quite crazy.
Yeah.
So with when you're working with a customer on creating their gin, how often do you come across someone who's very set in what they want, but you know that it's not going to work or that there's going to be an issue with that? How often
do maybe you one in 10 are not? We did have that experience recently where probably the first person that came along she, highly business oriented, had no interest in distilling, but turns out she has off the charts smell and off the charts taste and will make an extraordinarily skilled distiller, because some people are born with the higher capacity for smell and taste, and turns out she, through her career, had also developed those skills. She fully converted back around to wanting to make her own out of becoming interested in it, and she would be the only one, I think, that, we start talking about flowers and stories and building on that brand, and you've got to bring them back to what is realistically achievable and commercially scalable. And if you're starting to talk flowers and those sorts of things, as wonderful as the story is that goes with that, it is only a story, and that's the only bit you need to grasp. From when you're trying to create a flavor, you're trying to cue up subconscious, right? If you can get to a point where people can actually identify what the flavor is, you've gone too far. So we have one that's a summer gin. The key ingredient is passion fruit. 1 in 10 people tell me that passion fruit is that flavor. It is strawberry, raspberry, blackberry, passion fruit, right? And the thing that people say isn't passion fruit. They say it tastes like pavlova. Yes, that's what I wanted. That got to the right balance of all those flavors. So it was the last gin I made for ourselves and probably the last that I will make. And it is because of that trial and error of getting all of that combination of balance of flavors just right. And so, yeah, people come with an idea. It's much easier if you come with, well, we'd like you to create a flavor that tastes like, and they bring you a sample. You go, yep, we can make that. Once you've done enough of that, it's pretty easy to taste other distilleries' product and have a pretty fair crack at what their recipe is. I think when you start then heading into the compound method is one that we did a compound method gin for one particular brand, which is still going. They moved on to another distillery at that point in time, but that's one that I've probably not immersed myself in, and I think that there is from a commercial perspective quite a bit of potential on a gin side of things from going down the compound method.
Interesting. So certainly
for the people that don't know what the compound method is, explain it.
Yeah, so you distill all of your flavors individually under vacuum, and it's a piece of equipment, essentially a rotovap is what it's called. You can get different types of things, but essentially you distill your juniper, your coriander, your cardamom, and all of your other botanicals. And because you're doing it under vacuum, the temperature is low. And because the temperature is low, when you're using things such as bergamot or chamomile, rose, you can do it at a much lower temperature. And, you know, bergamot is particularly, if you overcook bergamot, you get the wet dog smell, taste, and it's not as appealing as what people think. It is a recognizable, it cues up subconscious, it just doesn't cue up positive subconscious. And so you can create, the good thing about compound method is there's less cleaning and it's more replicable.
You've got your recipe.
And you can distill, you know, years worth of juniper and keep it in a small container and just eke a little, you know, you then just take neutral spirit, you add all of your flavors to it in your exact proportion and recipe and bottle it. It's clean, it's relatively efficient. It's not so sexy from a still perspective, but, you know.
Yeah. But it's less of a story.
A lot more gentle on the distillation, isn't it?
That's right. Gentle. I think consistency is the key. We get variation in our products, and there's a certain element of we're craft. That's what we do. Every year, the blood oranges are different because of how much it rained at Mildura in the middle of the year. You know, but compound. It would be nice to be able to make it year in, year out. We opened up rum over couple of months ago, and you taste every one of them that's been put it down the same spirit, different barrels, and every one of them tastes different. Then you go to the next year and you go again, and you go, they're the same barrels, the spirit should be the same, and they're not.
Absolutely.
The joys of craft,
the trials and tribulations, and I guess the endless fascination and the endless possibility of craft all rolled into one. Yeah. Now we've hit the hour 20 mark. It's getting late. We don't want to keep you too late. We do appreciate you joining us this evening. Thank you very, very much. It's been absolutely fascinating. Do we have any, I'll put the word out for some last minute questions from the audience. If there are any, there's been a very lively conversation going on through the chat, mainly between Ian and Hamo, I think. They've been getting along like a house on fire.
Yeah, there is something going on.
I have put up a few links. Tim was kind enough to share a couple of economic resources for us. So I've shared those links. Perfume, The Story of a Murderer.
Yeah, look, if anybody wants to know about the subtle art of balancing flavors, this is an absolutely cracking book. I'm not sure how old it is, but it's certainly told in the story of a few hundred years ago. But it tells the story about ambergris. I'm not sure if you know the ambergris story.
No, I don't.
I know what it is.
Ambergris is the vomit of sperm whales, and it is an occulent. It preserves smells suspended in liquid, so it's used in perfumes, particularly high-end perfumes. And its unique characteristic beyond being an occulent is that it smells like human feces. What's important about that is that as humans, we actually like that smell up until the point that we can identify it. And that's the story told in this little murder, closed door murder mystery set in France in 17 something or other. It's worth a read.
There you go. Well, I'm grabbing the, it's not the exact cover there, but I'm putting it up. There's a YouTube link, an Amazon link going into the.
Thank you. I'll be ordering that tonight.
Going in there, I think that perfume, The Story of a Murderer. Yep, there we go.
There is a modern adaptation on it that was on Netflix a few years back, which is a
if you don't read, so
read the book first.
There is a movie. It got 59% on Rotten Tomatoes. I guess that's about average, isn't it?
the other 41% weren't distillers.
Oh, it's got Dustin Hoffman. I mean, and Alan Rickman. How can it be bad? Shit. There you go. All right. We digress. A couple of comments. Hammer, great discussion tonight, guys. Thank you. And there we go. Fantastic chat, Hammer. Also a great episode. Thank you for that.
Well, I'm Scottish, so yeah. Ian is...
So thank you all for joining us. Todd, who have we got in 2 weeks' time?
Watch this space. The bus.
Oh, that's right. We're waiting to lock them in. That's right.
Yes. Yep. We could have someone from the US or someone from Australia.
I think it'll be someone from Australia because I've given up on someone from the US.
I think the US one will be postponed. But
until we actually have them locked in, and then we might have to push people around to just suit it.
So, maybe Todd, if you're listening, Todd, not my Todd, US Todd, if you're listening,
answer your bloody emails, please.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us and for your wealth of information. It's been a great chat.
Anytime.
Thank you. And thank you all for joining us. This will go up online on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the rest of it tomorrow at this point. I'm not going to get to upload it tonight, but it'll be there. If you can give us a like and a follow and a subscribe and all those things, that would be awesome. If you are not already a subscriber to us on YouTube, please hit that little subscribe button. It does just really help us out. And we really would love to get over that 1,000 mark. That'd be fucking awesome. We won't make any money from it, but getting over that 1,000 mark would be, it'd just make us feel really good about ourselves. It makes us feel
like after 3 years, it's
we've made something of ourselves. We've achieved something.
Episode 84, 85? What are we up to?
84. I think this is 84. This is episode 84.
We are the unofficial, as I keep saying, the unofficial voice of the Australian craft distillers.
So all the support is very appreciated. We do love hearing the comments that people come back to us with. Crafty gets a lot of comments as he's out and about from people that are new to the industry.
Some of them are even positive.
I know. That's even more surprising. So thank you all. Stay tuned. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. And
a special guest.
Yeah. By Australian. Catches in 2 weeks. Tim, hang around. We're gonna roll the outro and we'll talk about the things we couldn't talk about on air.
Oh, where to buy a house.
Here we go.